call the next case, please? Wait just a minute, Mr. Hayden.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Let people get in and get seated first. To be seated, please. You may proceed. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I would like to reserve 5 minutes. May it please the Court, my name is Charles Hayden, and I represent Robert King Vaya, who was convicted of 12 felony counts by a jury in the Hampton Circuit Court and sentenced to the minimum possible sentence, 128 years and one day. We have assigned as error that the Court of Appeals erred in affirming the trial court's refusal of an instruction proffered by the defendant pertaining to the danger of convicting upon the uncorroborated accomplice testimony of Carl Gentline. In Virginia, a jury may, of course, convict an accused upon the uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice, but where accomplice testimony is uncorroborated, it's the duty of the trial court to warn against the danger of convicting upon such uncorroborated testimony. The evidence was clearly uncorroborated in this case. The defendant was not identified by the victims as being present at the scene of the crime. There was no DNA or fingerprint evidence linking him to the scene of the crime. He was not found in possession of any items from the robbery. The only thing that links him to the crime is the testimony of two accomplices, and that's it. Mr. Vaya, offered alibi evidence that he was elsewhere at the time of this robbery taking place. Now, this was evidence that was uncorroborated of accomplices, and the court had a duty to give this warning. It was requested of the judge to give this instruction. Did the court fulfill the duty in this case? Clearly, no. The Commonwealth argued, we didn't indict Carl Gentline, therefore he's not an accomplice. But, of course, that's not the test. The test is whether Gentline could have been indicted for the same offense. And clearly, when he was acting as an aider and abettor, according to Sanchez, he goes out and purchases from the Walmart the supplies, the mask, the tools that are to be used in the robbery. And he's the getaway driver. He drives the other persons to the scene of the crime. He waits outside while the others go inside. While he remains in telephone contact with robbers inside, one of the victims testified that the person they were listening to the person on the speakerphone inside the house receiving instruction from a person outside on the phone. That person was giving instructions to shoot them from outside. Clearly, when the Commonwealth suggests in their brief that Gentline did not share the criminal intent of the accomplices, that's completely unwarranted. The evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the proponent of the instruction, which is Mr. Vaya.
I understand what you're saying, and the trial court did rule that your client was not an accomplice and therefore didn't give the instruction. But the Court of Appeals held, in effect, assuming that he was an accomplice, that his testimony, that Gentline's testimony, nevertheless, was corroborated by Sanchez. And that was the reason that they affirm the judgment of conviction and judgment of the trial court. Now, that's a different reason than the court of, than the trial court. So, aren't we here to review the Court of Appeals opinion?
Well, the Court of Appeals opinion said, well, it's corroborated by Sanchez, and I've certainly pointed out, well, even where the only corroboration is the corroboration of another accomplice, the Jones case says that you still have to give the instruction. The Jones case stated that the generally accepted rule is that if two or more accomplices are produced as witnesses, they are not deemed to corroborate each other, but the same rules required of giving a warning about the dangers of accomplice testimony, uncorroborated accomplice testimony, and the same instruction is required as if there were but one accomplice. The two accomplices can't corroborate each other, and that's what I pointed out in my brief.
Well, let me ask you this. I understand you pointed that out in your brief, but your assignment of error says or indicates that you're disagreeing with the Court of Appeals because they erred in saying that Sanchez's testimony corroborated rather than contradicted Gentline's testimony. So you seem to be taking issue with the factual basis of corroboration, not the legal basis of whether or not accomplices can corroborate each other's testimony.
I would respectfully disagree. If you look at the Court of Appeals decision, it never explicitly rules that Gentline was not an accomplice. They appeared to assume that he was. They simply had a footnote saying, noting the fact Commonwealth didn't indict this person. That's all they say. They don't say we rule that he was not an accomplice or that the Court of Appeal, the trial court, was correct in ruling he wasn't. They simply assume, don't even attempt to dispute the assertion that, well, clearly there's evidence in the record, and we have to view the evidence supporting in the light most favorable to the proponent of the instruction. When it's viewed in the proper light, there clearly was evidence in the record to support the fact that Gentline could have been indicted, notwithstanding the fact the Commonwealth didn't indict him. He was an accomplice. When evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the accomplice. So the only explicit ruling that the court says is they seem to presume, well, they state, even if Gentline was considered an accomplice for the crimes, his testimony was corroborated by Sanchez. And of course, that's clearly wrong because accomplice can't corroborate the other accomplice's testimony according to a Jones case. That's the only explicit ruling they make. They note the fact that Gentline was never indicted, but they don't say, and we agree that he wasn't an accomplice. So we agree with the trial court's ruling. And clearly, the defendant made known his belief at the time of the ruling that he felt he was an accomplice, notwithstanding the fact he wasn't indicted, and he also never conceded that Sanchez's testimony corroborates the testimony of Gentline. In fact, the Commonwealth in their brief seems to. They seem to imply or try to suggest that somehow trial attorney conceded the fact that Sanchez might in some aspect corroborate the testimony of Gentline. Well, that's simply not the case. If we look on page 71 of the transcript where the objection is made, Gentline says, Mr. Baez's attorney objects to or asks for this instruction, and the judge says, well, you say Gentline's an accomplice and that his testimony is not corroborated, but if the jury concludes Sanchez corroborates Gentline's testimony, it's corroborated. The judge just makes this flat assertion, and then three times.
Mr. Hayden, I want to be sure I understand what you believe the Court of Appeals held. And it sounds to me that what you're saying is that the Court of Appeals held that the trial court was correct in saying that Gentline was not an accomplice and was correct in not giving that instruction. Is that what you say the Court of Appeals said?
I think when you look at what the actual wording of the Court of Appeals decision seems to implicitly concede that, well, there's evidence to suggest that under the rules set forth in Guthrie that Jetline was, in fact, an accomplice. They don't even dispute or try to say, well, and the trial judge was obviously right in concluding he was an accomplice. They never rule that. They never explicitly make that rule. They don't even implicitly rule it. What they say is Jetline, under quote to the Court of Appeals, say Jetline testified regarding his participation in the crimes as a getaway driver following the crimes. Jetline also testified regarding events and conversations that took place before the incident when Reginald Jones, the appellant via, and Samuel Sanchez planned the crimes. Even if Jetline, notice they never say, and we agree with the trial court that he's not an accomplice. They don't say that at all. They say they just immediately pursue Pete to assume that he is an accomplice. Even if Jetline is considered an accomplice for his crimes, the testimony was corroborated by that of Sanchez, who admitted that he, appellant, and Jones were the three men who entered Osh's home and threatened those inside at gunpoint. And, that, and accordingly, the court, trial court did not err in appellant's proposed instruction regarding Jetline's testimony. That's all they say. And they never say, and we explicitly ruled that the trial court was correct in ruling not accomplished. They didn't even say we implicitly ruled that.
Since they did not explicitly rule on that, they just assumed that he was an accomplice. The issue whether he was or was not an accomplice is not actually in front of us, is it?
It certainly is.
Mr. Hayden, tell me how. The trial court found he refused the instruction because he concluded that Jetline was not an accomplice. I'm not finished, please. The Court of Appeals did not address that, and you've not assigned error to the finding that he was not an accomplice. So isn't the only issue in front of us the Court of Appeals holding whether or not, at the end of the day, Jetline's testimony was corroborated by Sanchez?
I respectfully disagree. I don't think I can be taxed for not objecting to an implicit ruling that's never made clear. They never ruled explicitly. What I did say, whatever specious reasoning was employed by the Court of Appeals, my son Rivera says, quote, the Court of Appeals erred in affirming the trial court's refusal of instruction A proffered by Vibe, which pertained to the dangers of convicting upon the uncorroborated accomplice testimony of Carl Jetline, period. And that implicitly objects to, for whatever rationale that the trial court, the Court of Appeals used to uphold the trial court's decision, it was wrong. That's the implicitly, but to the extent that they made some kind of explicit justifications for the trial court's rulings, such as saying, well, he really, this Sanchez's testimony in some ways are corroborated Jetline's. Well, I proceed to object to that. But,
Mr. Hayden, that takes me back to my original question, which is, in your assignment of error, as you said, you then go on and say specifically the Court of Appeals erred in ruling that Sanchez's testimony corroborated rather than contradicted Jetline's testimony. Now, my question to you is, are you objecting to the fact that it says that they, to the fact of corroboration, in other words, corroboration versus contradiction, or the legal issue that an accomplice's testimony cannot corroborate another accomplice's testimony?
I'm objecting.
Because as I read your assignment of error, you're just disagreeing with how the Court of Appeals interpreted the testimony of Sanchez.
Clearly, I argue implicitly, for whatever grounds that whatever reasoning the Court of Appeals used to arrive at its decision in affirming the trial court's decision to evade its duty, the longstanding duty, the longstanding settled principles that the courts of Virginia that I'm asking the court to adhere to, the Court of Appeals was wrong. In the body of the brief, I proceed to argue about how, in the body of the brief, I discuss how he clearly was an accomplice because under the rules set forth in Guthrie. Now, I could suppose it's possible to write an assignment of error that goes on for pages, noting every nuance of, but I respectfully submit that my assignment of error subsumed within it the argument that clearly he constituted an accomplice. And whether the Court of Appeals based it on being an accomplice or not being an accomplice, the Court of Appeals erred. And so the issue is set forth in the brief, and this is not a situation where the Court of Appeals never was apprised of what my position is. I argued all along, he's an accomplice under the rules set forth in Guthrie. The Court of Appeals rejects my position, but they don't explicitly state that. Apparently, that might be a ground, but they don't explicit. So you're having to refer, but in order to avoid having unwieldy assignments of error that go on for sentence upon sentence upon sentence, you have to state the general ruling that was wrong, and among the parts of the explicit ruling of the Court of Appeals that there was corroboration, I explicitly noted that. To the extent that there were implicit rulings in the Court of Appeals, I implicitly object to that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 10 seconds left.
Good morning. May it please the Court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. The defendant's assignment of error proceeds from the premise that Gentline and Sanchez were, in fact, accomplices. And as the Court's questions today make clear, the trial court made a contrary finding. That's at page 71 of the joint appendix in this matter. The defendant simply has not preserved for appellate review that finding of the trial court.
What he has said. If you look at the assignment of error, it seems to me there's two ways that you can read it. One is the first sentence. The Court of Appeals erred in affirming the trial court's refusal of instruction proffered by Bayo, which pertained to the danger of convicting upon the uncorroborated testimony of Carl Gentline. That's one aspect of the assignment of error. The second aspect of, and specifically, the Court of Appeals erred in ruling, and then there's another aspect to the assignment of error. You either read the second sentence as being a greater informing of what the first sentence means, or you read the second sentence as being a separate issue. Having said that, why wouldn't he be allowed the benefit of the doubt of having preserved, at least for 517 purposes, both questions?
And if I may, in answering your question, I think it's useful to look back to the assignment of error presented to the Court of Appeals, and that's at page 36 of his petition for appeal filed in that court. And the assignment of error there was the trial court erred in refusing, and implied as the defendant's proffered instruction, which pertained to the danger of convicting upon the uncorroborated testimony of Carl Gentline. So the Court of Appeals was never called upon to address the trial court's ruling that they were not, in fact, accomplices.
And well, so maybe or maybe not, I don't know, but they clearly didn't decide the question.
Correct.
But having said that, he's then in a position of having a question that he thinks is wrong that they dodge. And he comes up here and runs the risk of saying, yeah, but there was another reason for the trial court's ruling, and you didn't say anything about it here, so don't you lose for that reason. So he covers his tracks. And he says, all right, I object because I assign error to the finding that he wasn't an accomplice. And frankly, I think he's correct on that. And then he assigns error based on an assignment of error that he reads as being two separate issues and you read as being one.
Well, and I'm not sure if I follow Your Honor's statement. I don't believe he has stated, as you suggest in the first part, that they were not, in fact, accomplices. I think an assignment of error properly ought to have to preserve that issue, to have taken issue with the trial court's finding, and then to lay out whatever is set forth in the actual assignment of error, whether that's one part
or
two.
Well, I don't think he has to, because all he has to do is address what the Court of Appeals did. So I agree with that.
Well, Your Honor, to Your Honor's point, and specifically to the second sentence of the assignment of error, if that, in fact, raises a new issue, I would submit that the principle of approbate and reprobate would prevent reaching the merits of the issue, because at the time that mattered in the trial court, when the trial court explicitly asked him, well, can the testimony of Sanchez corroborate that of Gentline, He answered in the affirmative. And it's not until the motion is filed after trial that that argument is raised for the first time.
Well, counsel, let's briefly actually reach the merits. Was he an accomplice?
I would submit he lacked the requisite criminal intent to be an accomplice. And I know counsel points out the telephone call that is testified to by one of the victims, that somebody, some unnamed party on the other end of the phone is saying, shoot them. And I would reference this court to page 27 and 28 of the joint appendix, where Mr. Gentline is asked specifically, did you have any contact with these individuals during the robbery? Were you on the phone with them? And he says no. And that testimony is unimpeached. So somebody was on the phone with them. We don't know who. And viewing that even in a light most favorable to the defendant as the proponent of the instruction, I would suggest it doesn't get there, coupled with the other evidence that suggests Gentline lacked the requisite criminal intent. He was afraid for himself.
So you think that a prosecutor would not have enough evidence to seek an indictment in this case because the guy says, I was afraid of the other guys. That's why I drove the getaway car. Well, we can't charge you. I don't see why a prosecutor could not have sought an indictment given these facts.
I would suggest there is no evidence to suggest this gentleman shared the requisite criminal intent. No party involved in the proceedings. So
even though Sanchez says he went out and bought the mask for the people, that still doesn't get you there?
And I would suggest that even if that's true, it doesn't address the underlying reason why he did so. There's no evidence that suggests he did so because he was interested in the proceeds of the robbery or because he wanted to assist them in the fruits of the robbery. The unimpeached testimony from Gentline is, I did it because I was afraid. These men had guns and I feared for my safety. At most, that's an additional step he took. He drove them. Maybe he went to Walmart. Viewing it in a light most favorable to the defendant, he went to Walmart. But it doesn't attack, it doesn't impeach the underlying premise that he did so because he was afraid.
But certainly a trier of fact could listen to his statement, I did it because I was afraid, look at all of his actions, and conclude that the two don't line up, and disbelieve or disregard his statement that I did it because I was afraid. So that really doesn't seem to support an argument that he could not be indicted as an accomplice.
And I understand Your Honor's point. I suppose my only response is, viewing the evidence that came out of this proceeding, even viewed in the light most favorable to the defendant, it doesn't support the conclusion that he acted with the same criminal intent. And I understand Your Honor's question, but I would maintain that argument.
Well, but what you're talking about is a defense to the indictment, not whether he could be indicted. I mean, he's got all the classic elements to be indicted. His defense is, I was afraid, I was coerced, I was against my will. But it's not a question of whether he could have been indicted. He certainly could have been indicted. But that's not that. I happen to agree with all of the premises of these questions, but I don't think that's in front of us. And Justice Lacy, I think, has narrowed this down to what really is in front of us. And then the question is there two issues in that assignment of error? Is there one issue in the assignment of error?
Well, I would submit that there is one issue. But even if there are two issues, even if this court were to address the merits of what the Court of Appeals decided, I would submit that there was sufficient evidence in the record, notwithstanding Sanchez's testimony, to corroborate that of Gentline's. Even if we assume, without conceding, that Gentline was an accomplice, even if we assume that the issue was properly before the Court of Appeals, if this court reaches that issue, there was the DNA evidence found at the scene linking to a gun. There was the testimony of the other participant at the scene, specifically naming the defendant involved in the offense. Those factors corroborate the testimony of Gentline, such that even if the Court of Appeals erred, it was right for the wrong reason. Well, I think it implicates him insofar as it corroborates the notion that there was a conspiracy, that one of these individuals was involved. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was the same individual who named Via to the police. And with the court's indulgence, I can return to the trial record.
Is there evidence that the gun belonged to Via?
It linked. There was blood found. I'm sorry, not on the gun. There was blood found on a fence and a nearby leaf that linked them to Jones, one of the participants named by Gentline, and Jones himself named.
Never
Via. No, but Jones himself named Via as a participant. And I would suggest, to the extent that Gentline's testimony named Jones and Via as participants, that those facts taken together corroborate.
Well, did Jones's testimony implicate Via, or did it implicate Sanchez and a person named Carl?
I'm sorry, that is correct. That is correct, Your Honor. And that's at 121 of the
transcript. So it actually implicated, his testimony implicated Sanchez and Valle. Not Valle, but Gentline.
That is correct.
So that doesn't help you any, the DNA evidence.
And I suppose at this point we would have to consider how much corroboration is sufficient corroboration.
Okay, well, what else is corroborating if we take out Jones's, the DNA?
Well, we have Gentline saying that Jones, Sanchez, and Valle were involved in this offense. We have Jones saying that Sanchez and Gentline were involved in the offense. And we have the testimony of Sanchez saying that Jones, Valle, and himself were involved in the offense. But those are the three aspects of the testimony setting forth what happened during the robbery. And I would submit whatever corroboration was necessary for Gentline's testimony need only be slight. And I would suggest that what was before
so
the
So what
trial,
you're saying is because another accomplice implicated Valle besides Sanchez, that corroborated Jetline?
I'm suggesting that his statement to the police.
Whose statement?
Jones's statement to the police, yes. It implicates Sanchez, and it is sufficient slight corroboration to support the testimony of Jetline as well.
Counselor, the Court of Appeals affirmed, apparently, on the basis that Sanchez's testimony corroborated Jetline's. Is that correct? Do you agree with the principle of Jones that one accomplice's testimony cannot corroborate another?
I believe that is still good law, but as I suggest, based upon principles of approbate and reprobate.
No, I just asked you, I understand your question, but under that principle, would you agree that the Court of Appeals apparently erred in holding that one accomplice testimony can corroborate another?
I think it would require, let me answer your question clearly. I don't think the Court of Appeals erred. I think implicit in the argument that was error, that finding was error, is the notion that they were accomplices. I think Jones is good law. I think if they were in fact accomplices, the testimony of one cannot corroborate the other. But I think in stating that Sanchez's testimony corroborated Gentline's testimony in this specific instance, the Court of Appeals avoided the application of Jones because Jones applies where they are accomplices. If they're not accomplices, it imposes no impediment. But I suppose
the beginning of their sentence in which they held that says, assuming Gentline was an accomplice.
And I think Jones is inescapable. I think it does apply.
But there's a second part of that I'm not sure you've addressed. In the Jones case, we said that you can't get corroboration for an accomplice's testimony by another accomplice. And that's the next part of it. You agree that that's still the law of the Commonwealth?
I'm aware of no jurisprudence that would have changed that. And I think I'm in the absence of that, I think I'm bound.
Going to your affidavit point, the Trial Court doesn't rule on that. How does that change the analysis?
I think to the extent any argument was made on that basis, it came at a time that was too late for the court to act upon it. And to argue now on appeal for a reason that was not articulated before the trial court at a time when it could act in that regard would be impermissible under the rules.
Even if the court didn't rely upon that representation in making its ruling?
I would make that argument, Your Honor. To sum up the Commonwealth's position, I think there are three procedural impediments to reaching the merits of this case. I think the trial court's finding that they were accomplices was not preserved for appellate review. I think to the extent the defendant argues on appeal now that the Court of Appeals erred in finding Sanchez's testimony corroborated that of Gentline's, that matter was not presented to the trial court at a time to preserve it for appellate review. And I would argue that the evidence would demonstrate that Gentline lacked the requisite criminal intent to be an accomplice, and the very premise of the assignment of error is incorrect.
I assume we don't find any of those procedural impediments to be a problem. What's your best argument for why we should affirm the refusal to give this jury instruction?
I have argued that the additional evidence adduced at trial was sufficient to provide the slight corroboration.
So that it was indeed corroborated.
That would be the Commonwealth's best argument if the court does reach the merits, Your Honor.
All right.
But, Mr. Katz, as a practical matter, if you were sitting on the jury in this case and Getlum testifying and there's no cautionary warning and Sanchez has testified and as a juror you're told, well, you have to be careful with Sanchez's testimony to see an accomplice. As a juror, wouldn't you think, well, Getlum is an accomplice and this is what he said, and so I think that's pretty strong and that would corroborate what Sanchez said. So wasn't there almost a double whammy against Mr. Leo without that instruction?
Only if it determined Getlum were an accomplice. And as I've argued, I think the evidence adduced at trial was the unimpeached testimony of Getlum, and I can't stress that enough. There's simply no evidence to rebut his assertion, I did this because I was afraid. And
well, that's based on believing him.
Well,
credibility is always a factor, even if you're not, if it's not contested in some way.
I think the trial court did not abuse its discretion in light of all the evidence adduced to make that finding. And I think there was simply no argument preserved that the trial court's finding was wrong. I think had there been some evidence to impeach Gentline's position, then absolutely the jury could have been led down that path. But given the way the facts developed at trial, I don't think the trial court was required to provide that instruction. The trial court found it would be unduly confusing in circumstances in which Gentline did not act as an accomplice. Thank you for your time today.
All right, thank you. Mr. Hayden, I think you have about 9 or 10 seconds left if you want to use them.
Suggestion that it was unrebutted that he was afraid, and he was left sitting out in the car for 10 minutes. If he was, and after the police arrived, it says, "I'm freaking out when I lose phone contact."
Thank you.